Welcome to Oncology Today, post-ASH MPN edition, a program focused on presentations from the 2023 ASH meeting on the management of myeloproliferative neoplasms. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Naveen Premaraju from the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. To begin, I asked Dr. Premaraju to summarize his take on where we are just prior to the 2023 ASH meeting in terms of the management of myelofibrosis.
I think the field of myelofibrosis nicely and unexpectedly experienced a golden era in the last year or two, despite the COVID pandemic. So there were four major breakthroughs that are in process or happening. One is that there's been several new JAK inhibitors beyond that of ruxolitinib, which most folks know about. So beyond ruxolitinib and fedratinib, pacritinib and momelotinib both gained U.S. FDA approval in just the last 2 years. And they represent a new era of JAK inhibitors where they might actually be able to be delivered in the setting of cytopenias, low blood counts, and actually may improve some of them. So that was a huge change by itself. So now we have four JAK inhibitors compared to one or two. The second major development heading into the end of the year was the combination era, which we'll be focusing a lot of here, which is not only the hypothesis, but now into randomized international phase three trials, two or three of them, upfront, untreated patients, never seen a JAK inhibitor, JAK inhibitor plus, and those data are very exciting, although a bit interesting and confusing, perhaps. A third development out of four, I would say, in our field is the concept of novel agents. So things completely beyond JAK inhibitor, which really were just in preclinical or phase one, 3-5 years ago. And now you have a panoply of those agents. Those are exciting. And we're covering some of those here. And then a fourth aspect is anemia. Anemia in myelofibrosis has been the bane of our existence for us as providers and our patients, not only transfusion dependent, but sort of chronic low anemia. People feel fatigue. And so there are several agents either by themselves or in combination with something, or even these new JAK inhibitors, which actually aim to improve the anemia. That's been huge. So all of that is exciting. It's real. It's in the clinic. And most of these ASH updates will cover those on the latest.
So, yeah, that was a great summary. What about, more in terms of the biology of the disease and our understanding of it, and also the hope to try to kind of reverse the underlying, pathophysiology?
That's a work in progress. That's the holy grail. That's exactly where the field is headed, what you just said. I think the two major developments there are the basic and translational science is starting to explode. You have many groups looking at single cell sequencing, stem cell biology, maybe the supposition that JAK2, the mutation that we all know, may not be the highest or most earliest mutation. So I think you're seeing a lot of these next generation sequencing, single cell sequencing, not ready for prime time for the clinic yet, but I think that will yield a lot. So those studies are ongoing mostly in Europe and the United States. And then I think the second development there is these novel agents, they're starting to show us retrospectively the different pathways. So imetelstat, for example, the first-in-class telomerase inhibitor, may not necessarily shrink the spleen or symptoms, but it's leading to overall survival in a phase two study. LSD1 inhibition, all of these other pathways. So I think the understanding of the pathways has multiplied, and you're starting to see the novel agents based on that. The question will be, where do these novel agents fit? Traditionally, as you well know, in all the other tumor types, you do them relapse refractory. If they work, you bring them into the front line. Here, do you combine them with JAK inhibitor? Do they stand alone? So I think those are the two aspects. So the preclinical biology and then the actual new pathways leading to drugs. That's happening.
One final question, and then we'll sort of jump into the data, is just sort of looking out at, referrals. I'm sure you get many from community-based docs. Any myths or misperceptions? I know when this whole era started with ruxolitinib, there was a misperception out there initially that it only worked with people who had JAK mutations. Any things that you're seeing nowadays in terms of maybe not getting out there to the community as fast as it'd be ideally?
Yeah, I can think of three things. I think, first of all, what you said is actually the most important and worth repeating here. The JAK inhibitors as a class work on the JAK-STAT pathway. So you can be wild type or have CALR or MPL or any of the other mutations, as long as you're confirmed intermediate to high-risk myelofibrosis. So I'm really glad you said that. So they're not JAK2 mutant inhibitors. They are JAK inhibitors. And on that note, there is development now of mutant-specific inhibitors entering into phase 1 trials, such as JAK2 mutant and CALR mutant, but that's in phase 1, et cetera. So I'm glad you brought up that point. But the three things I would say that are of interest to our community providers, one is to remember to check for the other mutations. CALR is actually the second most common mutation, 20 to 30% of patients in both MF and ET. And it's actually remarkable how often that's missed. So that can help you with diagnosis, making sure you have an MPN, maybe even prognosis. CALR mutant alone MF may do better than some of the others. And then finally, as I mentioned, very provocatively, there is now phase 1 studies, multiple studies of CALR mutant targeted therapies. So I think that's a big thing for testing. That's your heme path, you know, you as a clinician, you as your team. The second development I think that's helped our providers is allo stem cell transplant. It's getting easier, faster, better. More centers are able to do it. We have to say on this program that allo transplant remains the only curative therapy for MF. So I'm impressed and happy with how much more stem cell transplant is becoming more common, toxicity management, post-transplant Cy, all of these developments, haplo donors. So I think that's something we have to keep in mind. And a third development I would say is the longer term follow-up of ruxolitinib and the first JAK inhibitors showing that they remain safe, but that we have two or three things to watch out for. There's a little bit higher risk of shingles and some viral infections, non-melanoma skin cancers, and a little bit of weight gain, particularly if you're getting the drug at an earlier stage or in polycythemia vera. So all of these things are things we know about now, and they actually help in a practical day-to-day way.
Awesome. Well, let's, with that background, take a look at what happened at ASH.
Well, thank you, Dr. Love, and to the whole research to practice team. It's really an honor to discuss this with you. So let's begin at the era of myelofibrosis from a decade ago. And that really starts with the first agent approved, ruxolitinib, the JAK1, JAK2 inhibitor. And the two definitive studies were the COMFORT 1 and 2 studies published in the New England Journal now over a decade plus. To level set the field for myelofibrosis, intermediate to high risk, there were no FDA-approved therapies until ruxolitinib. And what we saw in the COMFORT studies, as shown here, is that the ruxolitinib versus either placebo or best available therapy led to a statistically significant increase in spleen size reduction, and the era and the field is marked by what we call SVR35 week 24, so spleen volume reduction at 24 weeks, 35% by imaging. And you can see that it was 42% of patients with ruxolitinib group versus almost none in the placebo group who experienced this SVR35 at week 24. The other supposition here is that you can take a pill twice a day in the case of ruxolitinib versus either placebo or best available therapy and get not only spleen volume benefit, but also symptom benefit, which is important in this disease. So with that baseline, this was thought to be a sea change and a revolution. How are we doing 10 plus years later? The one problem with this field is that the single agent JAK inhibitors, for the most part, vast majority of cases, are not curing patients alone. And so really, when you're on these JAK inhibitors, such as ruxolitinib, our colleague, Professor Polandri in Italy, showed kind of strikingly that at 3 years, 41% of patients, almost half, have stopped taking their ruxolitinib. Those are for various reasons, almost all of them, as shown here, for not good reasons, lack of response, lack of spleen response, adverse events, progression to more blast phase or even AML. Only a few of those patients came off to go to a stem cell transplant. And so the supposition from this very nice retrospective study was that actually patients are not on these JAK inhibitors for life, for a long time, and that actually either a sequence of JAK inhibitors or novel agents, in fact, the novel agents were associated with improved outcomes, or stem cell transplant or some combination would be needed for the vast majority of our patients. And so that sets the stage for the urgent unmet medical need going beyond JAK inhibitor monotherapy. Here, this slide is needing to be updated weekly because there's so many clinical trials now exploding in our field. But the concept here is JAK inhibitor plus another agent, either at the start of the myelofibrosis journey for the patient or add on or add back. You're already on the JAK inhibitor and add. And you can see here, there's a panoply of choices. Hypomethylating agents being the oldest, borrowed from the MDS AML experience, going all the way through heat shock protein inhibitors, BCL-XL, PI3 kinase, IMiD drugs, bromodomain, et cetera. The concept here as we go through these drugs is just to know that many of them are paired with the JAK inhibitor based on preclinical activity before they come to the clinic. So to give a sampling before we get into some more of the data, this is some of the development of the novel agents that stand alone. So these are generally given after the JAK inhibitor drug has either been resistant or intolerant for the patient, and now you're moving on to the second line setting. And again, a host of different drugs. Some of them include the imetelstat agent, which is the first-in-class telomerase inhibitor, LSD1 inhibitors, again, bromodomain inhibitors and BCL-XL, PIM kinase, CD123, and so many others, as you see. This slide also indicates the start of the era I mentioned to you with the mutant-specific CALR and JAK2 mutant targeting. So that gives you an idea. Why is this important? Well, as I mentioned earlier, in the vast majority of cases for myelofibrosis intermediate to high risk, JAK inhibitor monotherapy neither cures the disease nor reverses the fibrosis nor hits the myelofibrosis stem cell. And so our theory as a worldwide working group, as we published here in Cancer 2 years ago, is can we aim for disease modification earlier on, intervening earlier before the myelofibrosis has become advanced? And so the principle is, can we design drugs and drug combos that hit the microenvironment, that go to the other pathways beyond JAK and intervene before the disease has gotten to the accelerated blast phase or AML phase? And so let's look at the data. So one of the first approaches in trying this add-on approach is that of hypomethylator agent. The phase 2 study of ruxolitinib in combination with azacitidine, a common HMA agent used in MDS and AML, was conducted at MD Anderson by my group, including Dr. Masarova and Dr. Daver. Kind of strikingly and importantly in this study, what we saw was a 72% overall response rate in patients who got the add-on AZA, usually added at month 3 to 4, spleen clinical improvement of 71%, and a bone marrow improvement of 61%. Again, as you remember, the COMFORT data showing approximately a 42% improvement of the spleen. The supposition here is that you may have more AEs, more cytopenias, as you add in the second agent. The azacitidine, of course, can either be given IV or sub-Q, so a bit more difficult for the patient to tolerate, but overall, generally well-tolerated, no new AEs compared to what you would see in the MDS experience. A second combination approach is that of BCL-XL, and that agent, which is not yet FDA-approved, is known as navitoclax. This agent has been in trials for a decade plus in both solid and liquid tumors, but the principle is inhibition of BCL-XL, which is a pathway that has been shown preclinically to be overexpressed or involved in patients with MPN, such as myelofibrosis. On the basis of that preclinical data, we set out to do a phase 1-2 trial led by myself and Professor Claire Harrison, which we published in the JCO 2 years ago, which shows that if you add on the navitoclax, an oral agent, to the ruxolitinib in patients who are already starting to lose their response, so-called suboptimal responders, that we could show spleen volume improvement again, maybe even anemia improvement, and overall survival improvement, as shown by the Kaplan-Meier curve in this already advanced group of patients. The supposition is that you can add on a drug safely to the ruxolitinib with minimal side effects, in this case, which includes thrombocytopenia and GI side effects.
So I'm kind of curious, so what's the difference between navitoclax and venetoclax, and has venetoclax been looked at in MPNs?
An excellent question, which is in regards to the difference between navitoclax and venetoclax. Venetoclax is the already well-known agent which primarily targets BCL2, already FDA-approved in CLL, now an older AML, and being investigated in a host of other lymphoid myeloid malignancies. Interestingly, in myelofibrosis, not expected, it appears that in many of our studies, BCL-XL, the cousin pathway, the other pathway, is actually more highly expressed. And in the clinic, many studies with venetoclax in myelofibrosis or accelerator blast phase may not be showing as great of results as we had hoped for. And so the thinking is that since BCL-XL is a bit more highly expressed and navitoclax is primarily a BCL-XL agent, it also has some BCL-2 activity. This is why navitoclax has been chosen for MF studies.
Awesome. Let's take a look at the phase 3 study.
So with this phase 1-2 background, the excitement and encouragement was there. And so we sought to lead a phase 3 randomized study with the navitoclax BCL-XL agent, and that resulted in the Transform 1 study, which was a global randomized double-blind placebo-controlled study. Upfront frontline patients, JAK inhibitor naive, versus in the placebo or control arm, which is ruxolitinib actually plus placebo. And so let's look and see how these patients did. As we mentioned, again, the principle in this phase 3 study is the BCL-XL inhibition being more active potentially in MF and also maybe even having acquired resistance overcoming mechanism to JAK inhibitor monotherapy. In this phase 3 double-blind Transform 1 study, 252 patients actually were enrolled. One-to-one randomization of these patients, so adult patients, myelofibrosis, never seen a JAK inhibitor. You were stratified on the basis of intermediate 2 versus high risk and on your platelet count. Again, the investigational arm is ruxolitinib standard dosing based on platelets and navitoclax versus ruxolitinib and a placebo. Primary and secondary endpoints are standard for our field of myelofibrosis, including a sole primary endpoint, which is important to note, of SVR 35 week 24, identical to the COMFORT study. And then secondary endpoints, including, of course, symptom burden benefit. Now, in this randomized phase 3 study, 125 patients were randomized to the investigational arm, navitoclax plus rux, and 127 to the placebo plus rux. The median age was as expected for our field of 69 to 70. In this trial of mainly intermediate 2 and high-risk patients with myelofibrosis, you will note that a few patients, 8 and 5 respectively, had intermediate 1 symptomatic with splenomegaly allowed on study. All of these patients had splenomegaly, all of them had symptoms at baseline, and all of them had the expected driver mutations, as we've discussed here, majority JAK2, followed by CALR and MPL, exactly as you'd expect in a historical situation. The median follow-up was approximately 15 months, and many of these patients, as you look here at the bottom, have high-risk molecular mutations. So the readout here is an older, higher-risk group of patients enrolled on this phase 3 study. The main results are shown here. The primary endpoint was met for this randomized phase 3 study, which was that of SVR 35 at week 24. This is the visual depiction with the waterfall plot, and it's striking. 63.2% of the patients achieved the SVR in the investigation arm, the rux plus navitoclax, versus only 31.5% in the control arm. Again, you'll recall the COMFORT basis of 42%. Well, looking further at this SVR 35, we then sought to look at it at any time beyond the week 24. And remarkably, we found that even more patients, 79%, had this at any time beyond this endpoint. The other important aspect of this is to look at symptoms. So let's take a look at that together. Unfortunately, in this phase 3 study, the TSS responses, although both groups showing response, as you can see on the waterfall plot, was not found to be statistically significant in the combination arm versus the control group. Again, even though both patients benefited from the symptom response, this was not shown to have statistical significance. And in that setting, of course, when you add a second drug, you will add in, as you would expect, more adverse events. And so let's look at that. In this navitoclax agent, there were some signal for thrombocytopenia as expected in prior studies, anemia and neutropenia. And then the most common non-heme side effect was that of diarrhea, so GI. Importantly, outside of these AEs, the rest of these AEs, as you see here, were expected from prior studies. And even the AEs of thrombocytopenia, anemia, neutropenia, and diarrhea were expected as well. Now, the most common serious AEs, this trial was largely conducted during the COVID-19 pandemic, was COVID-19 pneumonia and pneumonia in general in 3 patients each with those designations. And dose reductions and interruptions were mostly due to thrombocytopenia, as you might imagine in the study. Although importantly, none of these were due to bleeding. And really during the clinical trial, these were easily and well managed with the clinical trial parameters for dose holds and reductions. So the supposition and the readout from this is quite amazing. You have a large study where the primary endpoint was met, clearly. Of course, the secondary endpoint was not statistically significant. And so the editorial from the prior study, which was led by Dr. Tony Lataya at Dana-Farber, showed that perhaps in addition to hitting the JAK-STAT pathway with JAK inhibitor, now we're actually leading to apoptotic cell death in these cancer cells by way of BCL-XL inhibition with both rational preclinical hypothesis and showing it in the clinic in the patients that were treated. And so that study is ongoing in terms of maturity of data with other readouts to be discussed at future congresses and meetings. And so we await those data.
So just kind of curious how the findings that you reported compared to what you were hoping for and what you see as the future of this strategy.
So far with the navitoclax experience, we can say a couple of things. One is, remarkably, the primary endpoint was met, essentially doubled, 60%+ versus only 31% with the spleen volume. So that is an exciting finding, and we'll await to see the durability and depth of that over time. The second comment, of course, is that as you saw, the TSS, the total symptom score, even though there was benefit in both groups, it was not statistically significant. And so what that means is you have a primary endpoint that was met, secondary endpoint that just missed. And so it's opened up a debate in our field, which is when it was monotherapy with ruxolitinib alone, this was a major secondary endpoint. Now, the question is when you add a second drug, you're going to add in more AEs, a little bit more toxicity. And so the question is now being asked by myself and others, are you really going to see a symptom benefit? I don't think we're going to see that in many or any of these combination studies. So I think that's important, as long as you're showing overall clinical benefit to the patient, spleen volume reduction, some of these factors. And then the third aspect, I think, as you mentioned, the future. So the T1 trial is ongoing in terms of maturity of data. There is also a T2, Transform 2, which is navitoclax ruxolitinib combination in the relapse refractory setting. So we await both of those data sets.
Is survival a reasonable endpoint in these kinds of situations?
I think it's good and important to have overall survival reported in all of these combinations. Generally, in myelofibrosis, even in intermediate to high risk, with the median follow-up here of only 15 months, it's too short to see that. So hopefully we will see that in all these combinations. But I would estimate that generally around month 24 or beyond, so 2 to 3 years point, would be where you would start to see OS separation if you're going to see it. And so, yes, I would hope that we see that for all of these combinations.
Let's continue.
So the second major presentation at the ASH meeting after the navitoclax was that of pelabresib, which is a novel BET or bromodomain inhibitor, which is also given in combination with ruxolitinib upfront JAK inhibitor naive patients with intermediate and high-risk myelofibrosis. And this was termed the MANIFEST-2 study, again, another global randomized double-blind study led by my colleague, Dr. Rajith Rumpel. So in this presentation at ASH, we learned several key things. That while there's no FDA approval yet for the BET bromo inhibitor domain class, this has also been around for a decade to two, actually, in terms of preclinical and clinical data sets. What we're trying to do with the BET inhibitor in myelofibrosis is to try to suppress the aberrant cytokine production of the malignant clone, promote healthy erythrocyte differentiation, and lead to normalization of the megakaryocytes and their differentiation. Now, this is also an oral drug that was tested in phase 1/2 trials showing both safety and efficacy, and that led to this important randomized phase 3. As you can see here, this is quite a large study, actually 430 patients randomized. These are patients with DIPSS intermediate 1 or higher, so intermediate or high-risk patients, splenomegaly, and symptomatic. It's a double-blind randomization 1-to-1, as you would expect in our field. And the investigational arm, as we mentioned, was pelabresib given at a dose of 125 milligrams orally daily, but importantly for 2 weeks, days 1 through 14. The ruxolitinib per label, with one important caveat that there was a 5 milligram BID lower starting dose for the first cycle, just to assess for safety until there was escalation. And then this was randomized against a ruxolitinib plus placebo. Primary and secondary endpoints, again, exactly what you would expect, SVR35, symptom benefit. And again, this 1-to-1 randomization, this is very similar in all the studies, will be randomized based on the intermediate high risk platelet count. So baseline characteristics of the patients is shown here. Median age, as you would expect in the field, is 66. And as you move down this chart, what is notable and maybe different from the navitoclax Transform 1 data set I showed you is a large amount of patients in this study were actually intermediate 1. Take a look at this. So 59.8% are intermediate 1 in the pelabresib combination arm, 58.8% in the placebo plus ruxolitinib arm. So these are two different studies. This one really features and focuses on intermediate one, but also includes intermediate two and high risk. The mutation profile is as you would expect. The baseline counts are as you would expect. And so let's start to look at the data. In this MANIFEST 2 collaborative data set, again, the primary endpoint was clearly and easily met. Again, as we saw with the Transform 1 navitoclax, essentially a doubling, 65.9% SVR35 at week 24 versus only 35.2 in the ruxolitinib placebo, highly statistically significant. Now, the interesting question will be is what happened with the TSS symptom score in this study? I show you here the TSS 50 response at week 24. And again, you can see clear benefit in terms of the waterfall plot for the vast majority of patients. However, importantly, interestingly, vexingly, strikingly, just as I showed you with the T1 data set, the p-value is not quite statistical significance here in this combination group. Now, the investigators further went on to look at what I believe is a very important and novel data set, which is called a composite response. And this is trying to look at people with the pelabresib Rux combination who both had an SVR35 and a TSS50 at week 24. This is a novel analysis that's not commonly seen in our field. Here, strikingly, the investigators found that in both, you had 40.2%, 86 patients, versus only 18.5%, which is 40 patients. Again, showing that you have a twofold increase in patients achieving both with the combination versus the placebo-controlled arm. Safety in all these new drugs is important. So I mentioned in the navitoclax, you have the cytopenias and GI, sort of similar here. You can see that cytopenias and GI, as you look at the data set, are common, but overall a well-tolerated drug and drug combination. And again, these are the treatment emergent adverse events showing this similar. There was one unique side effect of dysgeusia, which was seen in 18.4% of the patients in the combination versus only 3.7% in the control arm.
So before you go on, just after watching these two phase three trials, I guess taking a step back, it kind of seems different than a lot of the other phase three trials you see in oncology in terms of the endpoints. I mean, I'm pointing out something that's very obvious here, but symptoms, which there are a lot of things that sort of contribute to that, and even spleen volume. I'm not exactly sure if it's always like 100% correlated with sort of disease progression. So, you know, like in other cancers, we talk about PFS and survival, of course, but particularly PFS. Like, what kind of trial or what kind of endpoint do you kind of need in this situation? Or
right.
I mean, do you think these people are benefiting clinically, symptomatically? But also, yes. There's the issue of maybe they're living longer, and we have no parameter to figure that out, I guess.
Yeah, I'll correct what you said. I think myelofibrosis is a unique disease where the historical two have been spleen volume reduction and symptoms. But as you say, in this combination era, and as we follow people longer, I think it's imperative to do what you said, which is to follow for PFS, LFS, so leukemia-free survival, OS, overall survival, bridge to transplant, and maybe some other markers such as bone marrow fibrosis reduction, allele burden, molecular. All of these studies are definitely incorporating all of them. I think we'll start to see some of those, you know, as these mature into year two and three data sets.
So I guess, you know, what about just, you know, time on therapy in these trials? Was that different?
Yeah, that's a good point. I don't think either of these studies showed exactly that, but you're right. Now that you're adding in a second drug, I think we do need to focus and show that. So you're right. So time on therapy of each agent, right? So the JAK inhibitor, the novel agent, the combination. So I think we'll start to see those in the later data sets as well.
So I'm curious about selinexor. We were just at the SGO meeting, some really interesting things going on in endometrial cancer. But anyhow, let's talk about selinexor and myelofibrosis.
So now we move to yet a third exciting combination that was presented at the ASH meeting. This was by our colleague, Dr. Sri Thantarvahi from Utah. And this is selinexor plus ruxolitinib. This is a drug that many know as it's approved in the myeloma lymphoma space. It also has been associated with some clear toxicity at some of the higher dose levels, including GI fatigue and others. And so this drug is now being brought into the myelofibrosis space. earlier on study, but nonetheless an exciting combination to talk about. So this is the XPORT-MF-034 study, and it really is a quick escalation from phase 1-2 all the way up to now phase 3 starting. Again, combination of selinexor with ruxolitinib, JAK inhibitor naive frontline patients with myelofibrosis. Now, based on the experience from the higher doses and the toxicity, this trial smartly includes the drug at a lower dose. So you can see here, selinexor PO at only 40 milligrams Q weekly or 60 milligrams Q weekly, plus the ruxolitinib, a very sort of cautious, well-planned phase 1 dose escalation, then leading into a phase 1B dose escalation, primary, secondary endpoints, all same. And based on this, very interestingly and remarkably, quick safety and efficacy analysis, now they've already started into the phase 3 pivotal trial, which will be 306 patients, randomized 2-to-1, selinexor oral at 60 milligrams Q weekly plus Rux is the dose chosen versus Rux placebo. So again, similar construct to what you've seen before. Now, for the data that we've seen so far, just in a small group of patients, this is really only 14 patients in the phase 1 experience that we saw. Let's take a look at that. Among these 14 patients treated with the combination, again, the median age, always important to look at in these myelofibrosis studies, is 64.5 years. You can see that one of the patients was transfusion dependent at baseline. And again, the molecular mutations are around what you would expect. The majority of patients, JAK2, followed by CALR-MPL. You can see DIPSS risk here, that the majority of the patients are intermediate to and high risk. So again, kind of consistent with what you've seen before. Now, any new drug, especially this one, which has had some history of toxicity, we have to take a look at the treatment emergent adverse events. Here again, even with this dose reduction and the cautious and careful, well-designed study design, I would say that GI and nausea was still seen in the vast majority of patients, as you can see here. The investigators found it to be transient in nature with a median duration of around only 2 cycles. But 64% of patients in the 60 milligram cohort did receive one prophylactic antiemetic, and 67% of these patients had nausea, which was grade 1. 100% of the patients without antiemetic prophylaxis had nausea, grades 1 through 3. The other important point is that the median hemoglobin levels and platelet counts were generally stable with this combination early on. So let's take a look at the data. Very exciting. This is the SVR and TSS that we're now getting used to in the myelofibrosis field. Early on, limited number, small number of patients. But you can see remarkably at week 24, of the 12 evaluable patients, already 11 out of 12, essentially all, 92%, had an SVR 35 benefit. And then in the TSS 50, remarkably, 7 out of 9 patients evaluable, 78% at week 24, also had benefit. And you can see the waterfall plots here. Again, the caveat is a very small number of patients, limited data set. We're eager to see more data set, but on the basis of this, already now moving into a phase 3 randomized study.
So I was mentioning endometrial cancer. I assume it's not relevant here, but there they saw a difference based on P53 status. I assume that's not an issue in myelofibrosis?
Great question. TP53 probably in about 5% or less of patients with chronic myelofibrosis, but to your point, it increases dramatically in patients who are transforming to accelerated or blast phase or into AML. So in other words, TP53 can be dynamically acquired and picked up at the time of transformation. So it's an important marker to follow in higher risk advanced patients.
But I mean, there they were actually saying it was the TP53 wild type that responds.
I see.
Because of course, in solid tumors, you see P53 a lot, but they were trying to explain it based on the mechanism of how selinexor works, why P53 wild type should benefit. Again, if you think about the pathophysiology of myelofibrosis and the way it selinexor works in terms of the nucleus, does it seem like it sort of makes sense to use it in myelofibrosis?
Yeah, great points. Yeah, so the mechanism of this drug is still being worked out. As you said nicely, it is an exportant, so it is this nuclear export protein pathway. There is also some supposition that it may work in and around the TP53 pathway, as you said. So I think that these markers are being followed on their study in terms of molecular classification, but that remains to be seen, what you said.
All right, you got a bunch of other really good papers to talk about here.
Yeah, right. So continuing on our theme and post-ASH review, there were several papers that I wanted to highlight, really interesting and important really discoveries for our field that will have immediate practice changing implications. So let's go over a few of them. The first one was abstract 5174, which was by our colleague, Professor Vikas Gupta from Princess Margaret in Canada. And this really looked at the effect of new or worsening anemia on clinical outcomes in a large group of patients called the JUMP study. And the quick summary here is that the JUMP study is this large 2,000 plus single arm phase 3B expanded access trial. These are patients with myelofibrosis getting ruxolitinib, but trying to reflect in a real world clinical practice setting, meaning not exactly the patients who would have gone on Comfort 1 and 2 with the parameters there. So out of these 2,233 patients, what was interesting is they wanted to focus on what happens with anemia and ruxolitinib, as that's sometimes an issue in the clinic that can actually limit the dosing. And so what they found here is that in contrast to the controlled clinical setting in the COMFORT studies, the JUMP patients really reflected a real-world setting of patients. You'd see patients with platelets less than 100, a little bit lower risk myelofibrosis than would be ideally treated. And basically, overall, what they found, and that is a great study, is that the development of anemia did not prevent the delivery of ruxolitinib in these patients. Said in another way, that even though you do experience some anemia with ruxolitinib, it did not prevent the delivery in these patients, and they were easily managed. And so it opens the door for further studies of what we were talking about before, aiming for disease modification. If in some patients we're treating too late, this study shows that we can benefit patients by treating them earlier on in the disease course and maybe with higher risk features than what we thought before.
So that also brings up a kind of a basic question, but maybe it'd be worth going through in terms of the indications to use ruxolitinib. And, you know, I guess the, you know, in terms of sort of what's on paper and kind of what's in reality, I would guess that docs in practice are more mainly focused upon symptoms, but you tell me.
Right.
And what do you use as a gauge to start ruxolitinib?
Right. We found it to be a very well-managed drug. So in terms of on-label indications, it's important what you ask. It's indicated for intermediate to high-risk myelofibrosis, and that's the basic parameter for the clinical, but it's only for platelets of 50 and above. So if you're less than 50, you're not supposed to give this in terms of on-labeled indications. And so of course, that's where the pacritinib came in, which is approved exactly in that space. Now, in practice, as you say, because it's such a well-tolerated drug, many docs do end up giving it to patients with lower risk disease, intermediate one, and usually they'll have something, either large symptomatic splenomegaly, which this agent has proven time and again to reduce quickly and efficiently, or symptoms, as you said, or some other feature. I'm sure perhaps blast count that's elevated, something else that prompts people to treat. Also, people use the JAK inhibitors pre-transplant. So maybe you have a patient who's trying to go to allo transplant. Maybe you have 3 to 6 months, so giving the JAK inhibitor there. So you're right, not everybody gets the on-label indication. But the issue with that is if you're giving it in the setting of low platelets or low to intermediate risk disease, are you introducing toxicity, bleeding, all of those? And I think these studies show that it's safer and safer to give it in these earlier settings.
What are the situations where patients, you know, have symptoms or splenomegaly where you wouldn't use ruxolitinib?
I think that's a great point. I think the problem is that you have a couple of toxicities with ruxolitinib that you do have to know about. One is that there is a signal for increased opportunistic or certain infections, so viral infections, some of which can be severe. Herpes zoster, shingles, particularly around the eye. There have been case reports of patients with TB and other infections, so you do have to watch out for that. Number two is there is an increased risk of non-melanoma skin cancers, so we have a lot of our patients see a dermatologist. And number three is there is some toxicities day-to-day. Some people can have weight gain and other issues that may not be desirable if you're treating too early on. So like any other chemotherapy drug, it's a twice-a-day drug. You want to use it in the patients who benefit the most. But as you're asking here, I still think we have more studies to do to define who those patients are. So again, if you're giving a chemotherapy drug, you want to make sure the benefit outweighs the toxicity.
Any thoughts about the mechanism of the non-melanoma skin cancers?
We and others have looked into that. It's actually a great question, Dr. Love. Nobody has gotten the final answer on that, but I will tell you it started a whole field that I like to call oncodermatology. And so there's lots of theories. One theory is that the median age of our patients, as you saw in the study, is 68 to 70. Could it be that there is just a lot of predisposition already? Many of these patients have a history of UV exposure and have other risk factors. Importantly, as you said, it's not a melanoma signal. It's really more for basal cell carcinoma and squamous cell, which are actually quite common in the population. Two is beyond ruxolitinib, almost all of these drugs in our field either lead to or are associated with increased skin findings of interest. Now that you mentioned hydroxyurea, the old drug that you and I know well, even interferon, some of these investigational agents. So suffice it to say, there is something going on here. I would call it something like oncodermatology, and I would not rule out that the underlying myelofibrosis or the microenvironment or the JAK-STAT pathway aberration may contribute to this as well. So that's ongoing.
Interesting. Let's go to your next paper.
All right. So the next paper that I had selected for this forum is a really interesting one. So we've mentioned a lot about ruxolitinib, the first-in-class JAK inhibitor, but let's not forget about the second-in-class JAK inhibitor, fedratinib, which was FDA approved in the U.S. August of 2019. Here, Professor Claire Harrison in Abstract 3204 details efficacy and safety of fedratinib in a longer-term setting for patients with myelofibrosis and shows the results from the phase 3 randomized FREEDOM 2 study. So again, fedratinib is a JAK inhibitor, second-in-class drug that was approved just after ruxolitinib, and it was shown in both the JAKARTA 1 and JAKARTA 2 studies to be efficacious for SVR reduction and TSS response both in the frontline and relapsed or intolerant after ruxolitinib was given. In this FREEDOM 2, it was a phase 3 open-label randomized study, again, looking at longer-term benefit and complications of fedratinib compared with best available therapy, which we call BAT in patients with myelofibrosis who already had ruxolitinib, which is probably where a lot of people prescribe this drug. For background, I will say the reason why this is important is that early on in the development, the fedratinib had a signal for Wernicke's encephalopathy, later just termed encephalopathy, and actually does carry a black box warning in the US for that indication. And because of that, patients need to have thiamine checked at baseline. Thiamine needs to be replaced if it's low and needs to be monitored during the course of therapy. So this study aimed to look for long-term safety and efficacy signals. A large study in the field, 201 patients who were randomized. So 134 to the fedratinib, BAT 67, so a 2-to-1 randomization, as you can see. It was a nicely done study in the sense of we're able to see that there were no new safety signals. So that's very important for this novel agent. And that it highlights that you can give sequential JAK inhibitor therapy. So after ruxolitinib stops working, this is the major data set to show that, yes, you can give a second JAK inhibitor and still get spleen volume response, TSS response. And it also highlights that the AE discontinuation rate and side effect profile was not worse than expected. So that's actually very reassuring to see. So I think the overall standpoint here is in this already approved drug, now 4 or 5 years later, we're seeing no new safety concerns. And this remains a viable option for U.S.-based prescription approach. The third study to go over in this post-ASH setting is the Abstract 3207 presented by our colleagues from Memorial Sloan Kettering. Really novel and interesting abstract, which looks at the pactinib. So now the third of four FDA-approved agents for JAK inhibitor therapy with myelofibrosis. And they're specifically trying to look at the PERSIST-2 data set landmark analysis for clues for overall survival, which Dr. Love, you were asking about earlier in the field, are we measuring for overall survival? This is one of those studies that aims to look at that. So pacritinib, as I mentioned, third approved JAK inhibitor. It's actually a JAK2 inhibitor as it's largely a JAK1 sparing agent. This was approved in 2022, so very recently. And here, in this case, it's approved for a very specific indication, as we mentioned earlier, which is patients with myelofibrosis, platelets less than 50. So now you have ruxolitinib and fedratinib, which should be given 50 and over. This covers less than 50. So here, what's interesting in the PERSIST-2 is that the pacritinib agent early on did have a signal for potentially watching out for cardiac and bleeding signals, although later in my analysis and others, we did not see a major impact on that. So again, long-term safety and efficacy is key, and we have not uncovered any new safety signals there. But what's interesting in this agent, which is being given to high-risk patients, so thrombocytopenic myelofibrosis, which as you'll recall, already on the scoring systems has an independent higher risk, worse prognosis. The cytopenic patients that were enrolled on this PERSIST-2 and who had a reduction of spleen score, modest reduction, 10% or more, on the full dose of pacrelimab was actually associated with an overall survival benefit. Now, this is a retrospective analysis, but it is a landmark survival analysis. And this finding has not been seen with any of our other JAK inhibitors to date. So it is a novel finding. This was not seen in the best available therapy arm, even though the vast majority of those patients, 82%, were on Rux. And so the investigators concluded that if you're on the pacritinib, which you're able to give at a full dose in the setting of thrombocytopenic myelofibrosis, and if you're able to get symptom benefit, that these patients remarkably also demonstrated an overall survival benefit. So they hypothesized that maybe this third-in-class drug has benefits and salutary effects outside of the JAK-STAT pathway. It hits other pathways such as IRAK and other pathways. And so they concluded that you really need further studies in this JAK inhibitor space to look at overall survival, as you yourself nicely mentioned, and to explore the non-JAK pathways to see how they're contributing to this benefit.
That's really interesting, that last observation. Any thoughts? I mean, I guess you could explain it potentially by the fact that they were able to get more symptom relief, spleen reduction, less symptoms, better performance status. But obviously, the other question is it doing some, as we were saying, to sort of the PFS, so to speak?
Oh, wow.
The actual disease.
Yeah, it's another great reminder by you, as you have a great viewpoint of all the tumors, solid tumor, liquid. I completely agree with you. These are the discussions we're having where that's fine that we have our MF-specific endpoints of spleen and symptoms. But as you nicely say, and I want to highlight what you're saying, I completely agree. We must include PFS, again, leukemia-free survival as well, overall survival, so that we can kind of translate and understand these findings across tumor types. So well said by you. And those are being done.
We were actually having a conversation like this yesterday, believe it or not, related to checkpoint inhibitors, because everybody sort of assumed in solid tumors, I don't even remember what cancer it was, but everybody sort of assumes they're all the same. It was GI, actually. They sort of assume they're all the same. There was another checkpoint inhibitor had a little bit different mechanism of action, but they still were saying, oh, they're all the same. And I was saying, well, suppose that one was like had a survival benefit of 25%. Would you see it? And of course, you wouldn't. Like here, if it's happening, you don't really know it, I guess.
And further extrapolating what you're saying, FLT3 inhibitors in AML, all of those drugs hit other pathways. So we call these things JAK inhibitors, FLT3 inhibitors. But as drugs like sorafenib and others have taught us, these are multi-kinase inhibitors, and they must be studied appropriately. Well said by you. Very important point.
Yeah, and I mean, there's big differences in TKIs in terms of action. I didn't realize that. It's so interesting. Please continue.
Agree. So keeping on our track of kind of finding some of these interesting and engaging abstracts from ASH, this next one is by my colleague, Dr. Pankit Vachhani out of Alabama. And this is abstract 4554, which is a really cool abstract, which focuses on platelet response in pacritinib-treated patients with cytopenic MF. Now, again, as I mentioned to you, ruxolitinib is the first-in-class JAK inhibitor. We've talked all about that. Platelets 50 and above should be given. Fedratinib, the second in class we discussed, platelets 50 and above. And as we just mentioned, the previous abstract, pacritinib really focuses on platelets less than 50. Now here, this abstract is very clever. We've established that pacritinib can be delivered in the setting of cytopenic MF, platelets less than 50. That's the US FDA approval. But this study asks the question, can it actually improve the cytopenia? So what they did here is they looked at 117 patients who got treated, randomized actually to pacritinib. These are 75 patients from the PERSIST-2, the study we just mentioned, and 42 from another study, the dose-finding study called PAC-203. And so what they did is they looked at these patients, and what they found is that 14 out of the 19 patients that experienced this platelet phenomenon had actually sustained platelet improvement over 3 months. Unbelievable. Now, in contrast, they found that only 5% of patients on the best available therapy achieved this platelet response prior to the end of therapy. What's interesting for us is there was no difference in the rate of bleeding or hemorrhagic events, so that's notable. And all the other AEs were found to be about the same between the responders and the non-responders. Said in another way, not only can you deliver this agent in the setting of cytopenias, but this analysis suggests that it actually improves platelets over time in a good number of patients, not just on paper, but actually achieving what we call an IWG response, which has to be 12 weeks or longer. So it has to be a sustained response. And they found that it doesn't necessarily correlate or can be explained by changes in the spleen. I think this is important because you just nicely mentioned the other pathways in outside of JAK. The investigators actually go on that line and suggest that it might be that outside of the JAK-STAT pathway, since pacrytinib hits the IRAK1 pathway, so it's an IRAK1 inhibitor, they hypothesize, and further studies need to be shown, that it might modulate the tumor microenvironment, exactly as you were suggesting, and that may actually improve thrombopoiesis. Very cool stuff to basically say, remember the other pathways, and just because the prior JAK inhibitors may have worsened or exacerbated cytopenias, this one and the fourth one, the momelotinib, actually aim to improve them.
I was just going to say, I assume there's no study comparing Rux to pacritinib in patients without thrombocytopenia, but I'm curious what you think it would show. And also another question I hear from oncologists is, what do they do if they start a patient on a ruxolitinib and then they have problems with cytopenias, and then they look over there and they see pacritinib sitting there? A lot of them want to switch.
Yeah, I'll take that switching question first. That's going to be, I think, the next 5 years, the most important question in the clinical practice field. It's the same scenario you and I saw with CML. When we only had imatinib, then you increase the dose, maximize the dose, repeat the BCR-ABL. You know, when you only have one drug, you can only do one thing. You're right. Now that we have four drugs, I think you're going to see more early switching. I think it'll be not based on molecular or biologic, because we owe the field that. We don't have those factors. And I think you're correct. I think that now when you have thrombocytopenia that's early on, it could be drug-induced, as you said, could be disease progression, by the way, or it could be something else. It could be immune, ITP, whatever. So I think the supposition is, let's figure out what's causing the thrombocytopenia. If it is truly disease progression, yeah, then you have this agent to switch to, as you said. But you also have dose reduction of the prior agent, repeating, you know, all that. So I think you're right. Now, it also begs the question, why don't we have a biomarker to select between these JAK inhibitors? We don't, so we need that. And then finally, is there a difference between ruxolitinib-induced thrombocytopenia versus disease progression thrombocytopenia versus other thrombocytopenia? Yes, possibly there is. And so we need to flesh that out. For your other point, very nicely, it's very difficult to do randomized studies of JAK inhibitor versus JAK inhibitor. You do have some of them. The Simplify study with momelotinib did aim to do exactly what you said. So momelotinib versus Rux. But I think we need to do more of those studies.
Interesting. Please continue.
So continuing our track here of looking at the JAK inhibitors in sequence. So I'm very happy the way we're presenting this story to our audience. This is now looking at the fourth and final of the FDA, US FDA approved JAK inhibitors, and that's the momelotinib. Again, another potentially game-changing medicine in our field. This is Professor Ruben Mesa, who's now at Atrium Healthcare in North Carolina, who showed us an abstract 3182, a long-term assessment of transfusion intensity in patients with JAK inhibitor naive or experienced myelofibrosis treated with momelotinib in the phase 3 Simplify 1 and Momentum trials. So what's interesting for our audience is momelotinib was just recently US FDA approved within the past 6 months. And it aims to be not only a JAK1, JAK2 inhibitor, but also hits a pathway that may be new for many, which is called ACVR1. This and also the pacritinib, which hits ACVR1, we believe that's one of the mechanisms of leading to anemia improvement. So in the earlier studies, momelotinib, in addition to showing spleen and symptom benefit, also showed this nice signal for anemia response. And so it led into these phase 3 trials. The Momentum study was the latest one that really helped to lead to FDA approval. This is a clever, novel, interesting study which randomized the momelotinib versus actually danazol, which is an older drug that you and I know from before, which leads to anemia response in some patients. Anyway, in this randomized study, they found that patients who received the momelotinib had a much better anemia response. And interestingly, we learned here that they had a better maintenance of that response, meaning that they had less transfusions. They were able to get some patients to zero transfusion state. And that includes in the earlier studies that you had asked me about, even when they had had momelotinib versus ruxolitinib. That's the Simplify 1 study. Now, further than that, what they actually say is important. They're telling us from this abstract that across both trials, okay, both of these trials, that they found that if you have improved transfusion intensity, so you have improved anemia, this actually translates into clinical benefit for the patients, maybe even including overall survival benefit, with further studies being warranted. So again, as you asked me earlier, studies are trying to start to show what do these spleen symptom anemia mean, and you're seeing here that people are trying to correlate it to overall survival. Now, the next study is a little bit outside of myelofibrosis, but the reason why we're including it here is that this was a very, very practice-changing, potentially practice-changing study, which involves the same pathway I just mentioned. So I was talking about ACVR1 and hepcidin. So in myelofibrosis, you need to have people improve their anemia, but in polycythemia vera, it's the opposite, right? You need to bring it down. And so I wanted to just present this for completion, which is the long-term follow-up study of the REVIVE study. This is rusfertide, the first-in-class hepcidin mimetic in patients with PVERA, which was presented by my colleague, Dr. Ellen Ritchie. So here in polycythemia vera, just to turn gears for just a second, this is the MPN in which is associated with too high of blood counts, usually not only the red cell mass, but also the white count and platelets. And so this rusfertide, this hepcidin mimetic, which is a once-weekly injectable, aims to control red cell production in patients with PV by limiting and redistributing iron availability, thus leading to a more normal hematopoietic state. So this REVIVE study was conducted as a phase 2, and it was only in patients who are phlebotomy-dependent PV. And interestingly, they can be with or without concurrent cytoreductive therapy. I want to highlight that. So smartly, the trial included, if you're already on hydroxyurea, ruxolitinib, interferon, you're allowed to stay on. But you had to be phlebotomy dependent, so uncontrolled PV. Kind of a complicated and complex and intriguing study design of a part one dose finding with a part two blinded withdrawal and a part three open label extension. But the concept here is you're trying to see if this drug as the primary endpoint can render patients phlebotomy free and bring them to the goal of below 45. Remarkably, the primary endpoint was clearly met. In the rusfertide hepcidin mimetic arm, 69.2% had highly significant efficacy in this arm versus only 18.5% in the placebo. So again, this response rate of 69.2% was highly statistically significant and meant that the vast majority of patients were easily able to achieve phlebotomy dependency with this novel approach. Well, what about sustainability and durability and frequency of phlebotomies? You can see here that in patients who continued on to part three, so several months later into the trial, that almost half of these patients were treated with phlebotomy alone or phlebotomy with cytoreductive therapy. The cytoreductive therapy component is fascinating because likely in the real world, if this drug were to be approved, patients and providers may in fact use this as an add-on to the current therapy. And so that's nicely built into the study and you're seeing benefit there. So phlebotomy independence was achieved in the majority of patients in this phase two approach. And so this has now led to the ongoing phase three trial known as the VERIFY study, which is an active clinical trials at the global level, aiming to enroll approximately 250 patients with PV. And you can see the study design here. Again, it's the rusfertide plus your ongoing therapy versus your ongoing therapy and placebo in a randomized one-to-one fashion. And again, you have this sort of open label extension period to really follow people for durability of their phlebotomy dependency. The key take-home point is that as we discussed with myelofibrosis and anemia, these pathways of ACVR1, also known as ALK2 and hepcidin, have become one of the most dominant stories in our fields of MF and PV, of course, opposite ends of the spectrum. One final abstract to discuss that was important from the ASH meetings is again focusing on this pathway of ACVR1, or also known as ALK2, and this is with a novel agent in myelofibrosis known as zilurgisertib. So the zilurgisertib plus or minus ruxolitinib is being tested in the so-called LIMBER 104 study. And what's interesting is as ruxolitinib perhaps is associated with causing a bit of anemia, the zil drug is trying to offset that and improve the anemia. Very fascinating design. So in this, they're looking at the monotherapy of the zil drug alone, the add-on to ruxolitinib, and then the combination in the upfront setting. Again, the primary endpoint here in this early stage phase 1-2 is safety. But take a look at the secondary endpoints. Very interesting. It is anemia response, so specifically spelled out. And if you're non-transfusion dependent at baseline, there's a parameter versus transfusion dependent. And then the usual secondary endpoints in these type of studies. But really, the focus is on anemia and anemia improvement. I think that's fascinating. So in this study, early on, what we saw in the ASH oral presentation is that certainly you are seeing patients improve the anemia of MF in the different cohorts. And so what they concluded is that in this drug, which is safe and efficacious, that they will continue to monitor this and to see if these anemia can be seen in a larger amount of patients, the depth and durability of them, and they can correlate it with other molecular parameters.
I wanted to ask you about another drug because it sounds similar to something we've been talking about in breast cancer. What about PI3 kinase and partial liquid?
Yeah, I have a major update for that. That was a key combination that we were following, but unfortunately that program has been halted. So those phase 2 and phase 3 data sets have been halted. Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah. Yes. Any other maturing trials out there right now that we might be seeing over the next year, or any data sets that you think could be coming out over the next 6 months or year?
Yeah. One I want people to focus on is that of the Imetelstat program. So again, that's the first in class telomerase inhibitor. It's already in active testing and trials for MDS, myelodysplastic syndrome, particularly in low risk with anemia dependence, and also in our myelofibrosis. There's an ongoing phase 3 randomized study of Imetelstat versus best available therapy, patients with myelofibrosis, 2-to-1 randomization for the Imetelstat. And what's intriguing about that, and I'm surprised I forgot to mention that to you earlier since you nicely asked, that's the first trial in our field where the primary endpoint is overall survival. And so as Dr. Love, as you asked me earlier, are we moving towards PFS-OS? Yes, we are. And that trial is the first one really in our field to do that. So we're eagerly awaiting not only the results, but because of the endpoint.
Another sort of real world issue is a diagnosis of myelofibrosis.
Yes.
I don't know whether, again, in second opinion, you see patients who maybe weren't picked up as early as they might be.
Yeah, this is an important point. There's a couple of key factors there. So because myelofibrosis is such a rare diagnosis, maybe 4 out of 100,000 Americans a year, it can be either missed or mimicked by other conditions. And I'll give you a few examples. One is in a case where somebody suspects myelofibrosis, big spleen, cachectic, bone marrow is a little bit unequivocal, JAK2 is negative, and then the workup stops. I see this very often. So again, it's a reminder to keep going with the workup. First of all, they can be CALR or MPL. 90% of our patients have one of those three. The other 10% are triple negative. So keep going, working with your pathologist for molecular workup. Two is I repeat bone marrows quite often, partly because of the disease itself, the fibrotic nature, can lead to the so-called dry tap. It can be operator dependent. Maybe it was aspiration alone, Neil, and not the biopsy. So remember to go for the repeat biopsy. Nobody likes to do it. Patients don't like it. Family members, maybe you don't like to do it yourself, but it's imperative in these tough diseases. And actually doing a repeat marrow a month later may actually show a completely better picture than the one before. The third aspect I would say is there are some other mimicking conditions. There's something called autoimmune myelofibrosis. So I've published on this before. We've made a diagnosis of fibrosis in the bone marrow, but it didn't meet the WHO or now ICC criteria for MF. And so more imaging, more tests, history, physical, repeat assessments have shown very different things. One young patient ended up being Castleman's disease, and there's a condition called TAFRO, so Castleman's with fibrosis. Another older patient ended up being T-cell lymphoma, and the autoimmune fibrosis or autoimmune myelofibrosis was a harbinger or like a paraneoplastic phenomenon. And so my teaching there is not all fibrosis in the bone marrow is myelofibrosis. It can be a secondary phenomenon from another malignancy, infection, solid tumor. So really, when we use the word myelofibrosis, maybe with a capital M, it should be the actual entity. And then note that there's fibrosis that can be telling you something else is going on.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Pemmaraju, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.